This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoane. The relationship we have with our brothers and sisters is generally the longest, most enduring one we have in our lifetime. They share a childhood with us, and many will live with us into old age. Jeffrey Kluger writes about his brothers in his new book, The Sibling Effect, saying the four of them were a loud, messy, brawling, loyal, loving, lasting unit. His book is part memoir about his parents' messy marriage and divorce and its effect on him and his brother. He also writes about the interesting new research on birth order, sibling conflict, single children, twins, blended families, and parental favoritism. Jeffrey Kluger is a science editor for Time Magazine and joins us on Radio Times. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times, Jeffrey. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And would you still describe your brothers as a loud, messy, brawling, loyal, loving, lasting unit?
Yes, I would include emailing and texting as well, since we have moved into the 21st century.
Indeed. But what do you think explains the deep bond that you so clearly have with your brothers?
Well, there are a lot of things that go on. As you say, certainly some of the traumas that we experienced in childhood played a big role in this. People often think that those kinds of familial earthquakes can really shake these relationships apart and cause them to form all sorts of stress cracks. But among siblings, particularly among siblings when parents are divorcing, it often has the opposite effect. It often has, to mix my metaphor here, a sort of annealing effect. In the same way metal can become flexible, more flexible and tougher by being heated and cooled, I found the same thing happened in our relationship, and quite a bit of research does show that. Also, the fact that we're all boys, the fact that we're close in age, a lot of other variables played into the kind of bonds we've maintained our whole lives.
Now, like a lot of families, you have more than just these blood brothers in your family. Can you expand your blended family and tell us who else is included?
Well, yes, and this is one of the reasons that I wrote this book, because I have had siblings that appear in sort of all the possible flavors. I had two stepsisters for a short period. I have a half-brother and a half-sister who also happen to be twins. And so I've had those experiences that scientists look into in a very real and personal way. My relationship with my step-siblings didn't last more than the 15 months my mother's second marriage did. So those girls have played a rather small role in my life and in the lives of my brothers. But my relationship with my half-siblings has been extraordinary and a rich and loving one that didn't even start until they were in their early 20s and I was in my early 30s.
Now, why do you think that happened?
Well, there are a lot of things that were at work there. I mean, we didn't really know each other until then. They were, due to craziness in my father's second marriage, they didn't even know we existed until they were in their teen years. So there was a lot of pathology going on that kept us apart. But once we got to know each other, I think that the shared experiences, even if we experience those things in a parallel way, parallel non-intersecting way, the shared experiences with similar people in similar family groups really gave us an innate sense of kinship. And I think the genes we share really gave us certain temperamental consistencies, so that, you know, I find that I'm very much like my little sister in a lot of ways and very much like my little brother as well, even though I didn't grow up with them.
It sounds like you and your brother said that you did grow up with. It sounds like there was a lot of closeness, but it sounds like there was a lot of fighting and wrestling and perhaps rough and tumble play and you know, scary stuff, I guess, that boys traditionally get involved in. Were you a combative foursome?
We were absolutely a combative foursome, but by no means outside the median. We didn't go past the standard deviation, as scientists would put it. And there were a couple of things at play, and the same things that are in play in all sibling relationships. First of all, siblings do fight. They are hardwired to fight a lot. That's no surprise to parents. In the 2 to 4 age group, kids may fight as much as once every 9.7 minutes, which
in fact,
is extraordinary.
And I have to say, I circled that in your book because that sounds like warfare.
It's absolute warfare. And even when they grow up, get a little bit older in the 3 to 7 age group, it's still one fight every 17 minutes. By the way, when the scientists look at this, they don't call just one shove or provocative statement a fight. That doesn't count. It has to be three exchanges, a shove back, and then screaming, or something that go three hostile exchanges before it counts as a fight.
Wow.
Now, what's going on here, though, is some very, very powerful learning about conflict avoidance, conflict resolution, about when to step up, about when to stand down, about how to work through issues like this. And while as kids mature, physical fighting becomes less and less acceptable to the point that in adulthood it can even be criminalized, we still are a combative species. We still are a species that is going to have to spend our entire time on the planet negotiating, giving, and taking with other people. And all of those skills are learned in the playroom early on. Boys tend to do it in a much more physical way. There's a lot of areas in this research in which, for better or worse, both genders hew fairly closely to stereotype, and boys tend to be more physical about it than girls are, though girls by no means are immune from the physical fighting, as I see with my own two daughters who are 8 and 10.
Well, I mean, it sounds very much like the survival of the fittest. I mean, the fight over territory. Property.
Well, exactly right. And it's not so much territory as it is property with kids. In one study that I cite in the book, a researcher found that 90% of all fights among school age and younger children involve combat over property. And that's not a surprise, particularly with very small children. Kids are essentially helpless people who are acted upon by the grown-ups and the circumstances and their surroundings. They have very, very little autonomy. One of the few ways a small child, even a baby, begins to project any kind of power is over the objects that baby owns and controls. So property becomes a very, very important proxy for independence. That's the reason kids will think nothing of encroaching on somebody else's property, but will scream bloody murder when somebody encroaches on theirs. So kids do, from babyhood straight through early teen years, it does become about who touched my toy, who touched my clothes, who borrowed my brush without asking. There's a great sense of this being my inviolable world.
And did your parents intervene? When your brother's
intervention fought? Is, well, our house was always a little crazy, but intervention is critically important when there's a risk of somebody getting killed, of course. It's also critically important when one child, and it's usually the smallest and youngest, but not always, one child is the one who's taken advantage of the most, and the other one, usually the oldest, but not always, another one is sort of rules with too much of an iron hand. Parents need to intervene then if those patterns are forming. But often parents do need to just keep an ear open and let kids resolve some of these things on their own.
You describe as a kid growing up with your brothers, it sounds like you would get up before your parents and you'd be down in a playroom or the basement making noise, you know, as kids will do. And your mom would generally sleep through this noise, but your dad would get up and your dad sounded like a scary guy.
He was a scary guy, and I opened the book with this scene. I never really understood fully the source of his anger, but there was no question that he was an angry man, and when he was awakened early on a Saturday or Sunday morning, he would storm down to the playroom and sort of begin randomly administering corporal punishment to whoever was within arm's reach. My brothers and I coped with that by developing a scatter and hide strategy in which at the moment we heard footsteps from above, we would dash into our predetermined hiding places. For me, it was a shelf in the closet. For my brother Steve, it was scooting under the couch. For the number three brother, it was hiding in a window seat toy chest. And for the baby, it was the fuse cabinet, which was not the safest place to put a four-year-old by any means. But, you know, we told him, hey, it's just like Alan Shepard's space capsule. And he would climb in then, and we'd close the door and then all scatter. Now, the way we've told the story over the decades that followed is that my father would come downstairs and be flummoxed by the silence and wouldn't know where we were and would sort of scratch his head and leave the room mumbling. And that may have happened once, but, you know, I suspect it really never played out in that much of a sitcom way. I suspect that after the first time, we gave ourselves away and the hitting probably resumed. But what we took from that was this sense that we were independently reasonably strong kids, but we were exponentially stronger when we pulled together and looked after each other.
You know what I find so interesting, and I haven't done no scientific research on this, but when I talk to my siblings, is we'll talk about a family event, and it is like Rashomon. I mean, we often will come away with three very different reactions to something that we all shared, and I'm curious whether you find that with your brothers.
I do, and it's not just three very different reactions. It's three or four entirely different recollections.
Exactly.
Of the sequences of events, of who was there, of what was said, of how it was resolved. And indeed, with this book, I often would run things past my brother Steve, because he was the oldest, he still is the oldest, and he still has a scarily comprehensive memory, so details rarely escape him. And while I am inclined to defer to his memory of long ago events over mine, there were times that I just couldn't do it, because my memories were so crystalline, so clear, that I couldn't believe that his, which were equally crystalline and clear to him, could be the valid ones. But that's what happens. Mm. That happens among siblings. It happens among witnesses to a crime. It happens any time people observe things in a group. But it happens more acutely with siblings, because the things they experience in common are so primal, and they happen so frequently. They spend their entire early lives together.
You say, and we actually have a guest waiting in the wings who we'll talk to after this very short break, but you say whether parents admit it or not or know it or not, they have favorites among their children. Looking at yourself and your three brothers, who do you think your mom's and your dad's favorite was?
Oh, well, there was no question about it. Steve, the oldest, was my father's favorite, and that was based on the very common concept of primogeniture. He was the oldest, he was the firstborn, he was the one whom Dad saw as the heir apparent. Now that, you know, I may not always speak well of my father in this book, but that's a perfectly common and perfectly defensible position. And indeed, nature sort of demands that parents, or strongly suggests parents, take that position. Because by the time a secondborn comes along, parents have invested two or three or more years of time, money, energy, love, even calories in a firstborn, and nature says, look, your goal in reproducing is to create a healthy child who's going to carry your genes and get your genes across to the third generation. So you got to keep pouring investment in this firstborn and use the secondborn just as a hedge. My mother's favorite was my youngest brother, Bruce, because he had all of the survival charms babies of the family usually learn. He was charismatic, the funniest, the most charming. He was the most engaging. He had the most intuitive sense of what was going on in other people's minds, which are very important, what scientists call low-power skills that help the baby and the family get along. My mother's preference for Bruce was also magnified by my father's antipathy for Bruce, and he often would have a particularly free hand with corporal punishment with Bruce. And that's also not at all uncommon, that a mother in particular will double down on protecting a lastborn. Evolution doesn't like that. Evolution thinks that's a waste of genetic energy, but human beings, while our primal coding is genetic, we also have a whole lot of compassion at work. And that's one of the things that separates us from the animals.
Let's take a very short break. Jeffrey Kluger, our guest. The book is called The Sibling Effect. We'll be right back.
Christiana Care Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, Christiana Care cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year, and the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. Christiana Care, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We hope to put this fall membership campaign to bed by the end of the week, and we can only do that if you become a supporter of WHYY. Think of what you get 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, a mix of lively and timely interviews, news stories, and entertainment. Your pledge at 1-888-345-9499 or at whyy.org allows us to keep you informed. So do your part and become a member of WHYY. Thanks.
University of the Sciences in Philadelphia supports WHYY. Philadelphia College of Pharmacy at University of the Sciences is the nation's first educational institution to teach pharmacy and offers a direct entry admission option that allows students to earn a Doctor of Pharmacy in 6 years. Since 1821, the college has been preparing professionals in pharmacy practice, science, and healthcare. A blend of science and patient care, pharmacy is a challenging and fulfilling profession. Connect with Philadelphia College of Pharmacy at usciences.edu/pharmacy.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jeffrey Kluger. He's science editor at Time Magazine, and he's the author of a new book called The Sibling Effect, and it's subtitled What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. An excerpt of the book about parental favoritism was printed in Time Magazine, and Bonnie Rockman, who covers parenting for Time, took issue with some of Kluger's thesis, and she joins us on Radio Times. And Bonnie Rockman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here, Marty.
And you turn to your 6-year-old daughter. She seems like she's where you get your answer to this question about whether you have favorites among your three children. Are you telling us that you don't have favorites?
I don't have favorites. Yeah, with all due respect to Jeffrey, I'm in that. I can't remember if it happened to be 30% or 35% of parents who actually don't have a favorite. Yeah, I love them all the same. They drive me crazy all the same. It just depends on what's going on at the moment. So I can't honestly say I never have a favorite, but it's a favorite based on what's going on at the moment. Someone who's done something particularly amazing or particularly infuriating becomes my favorite, or the kid who I just really don't want to interact with at the moment.
Well, Jeffrey, you say whether parents know it or not, they have a favorite somewhere buried deep in their heart.
I do think that's true, though. First of all, in fairness, I want to say it's impossible for a scientist, never mind a non-scientist like myself, to know what's inside any one person's or any one parent's heart. So certainly I want to get to say that out front. But I think it's important to remember that when we talk about favoritism, we're not talking about which child you love more. Parents really can love their children with an equal ferocity, and that never has to change. But there typically will be a child with whom you connect more naturally, whom you understand better, who's more like you, which is very attractive, or who's less like you, which may also be attractive, who makes you laugh harder, who makes you think harder, who you simply have an easier time getting along with. I sometimes think, you know, if you put parents under sodium pentothal and say you're going to be stuck on a desert island for the next 6 months with only one of your children, who's it going to be? I have a feeling all parents would make a choice. Now, again, as Bonnie points out, and I think quite wisely, a lot of this also changes depending on circumstance, depending on domain, depending on, you know, whether you're talking about what happens in the living room or on the soccer field or at the dinner table or in the classroom. And all of these areas are ways in which any one child may be sort of the transient favorite. But over the course of a full childhood, I do think that one child will come out at least slightly on top in terms of the esteem and the connectedness each parent feels.
Bonnie, you want to respond to that? And your kids are young, yes?
They are young. They're 4, 6, and 8. So, you know, one thing that I am personally curious about is this going to change for me as my children get older and come into their own personalities even more? Which is possible. I mean, by the time they're in their mid-20s, I may be able to distinctly say I prefer this one over that one. But at the moment, I do feel like each of them have aspects of their personality that really resonate with me. And each of them have aspects of their personality that I find really off-putting. And I think that's completely normal. I think that's really normal for parents, for children, for friends. You have, just like when you think about close friends, you have the girlfriend. I have a girlfriend who I call when something has, I need to dish about my husband. I have a girlfriend who I call when I'm concerned about one of my kids. I have a different one that I call when I want to talk about stuff going on at work. Mm-hmm. So I feel like there are different aspects of my children's personalities that I connect with in very visceral ways, and that make me really, really want to be with them, want to spend time with them, and prefer them at a certain moment in time. But I can't say that one of them has something about them that makes that trumps the other and just rises to the top.
Well, Jeffrey, let me go back to you. You're also a parent. You have two girls. Is that right?
Yes.
All right. Well, I'm putting the pressure back on you. Do you have a favorite child?
Well, let me say this. My answer to that question
Don't
is always.
Yeah, really.
What I always say is, I believe 95% of the parents in the world have a favorite. The other 5% are lying about
right.
it. And the only exception is my wife and me.
Oh, no, you can't do that, Deborah. That is not fair. That is not fair.
I know. It's very convenient. I say that by way of saying that most parents, even if they feel a favorite, will go to their graves denying they have one, which, as I point out both in the story and in mm-hmm. the book, is in its way an act of love in itself. My mother is 80, and she still won't admit that Bruce was her favorite. But, you know, we know he was. We know he still is. And yet that sort of, when she still insists it, that sort of gives me a sense of warmth. I do want to say that I completely agree with what Bonnie just said, and this is one of the reasons, by the way, I love reading her stuff on Time.com because it's always so smart.
Yeah.
But she is right when she says that in so many different areas and moments, you feel a sense of preference for one child over another, and you turn to each child for different reasons and get different rewards out of each child. And over the course of a whole childhood, as long as all kids are aware that there were times and places and situations in which they were the favorite, they won't be at all mm-hmm. damaged by the fact that even if, on average, at the end of the childhood, kids can still say, yeah, but I always know the child A, B, or C was mom's favorite or was dad's favorite. Because the gap just isn't that different.
Well, you know what? We're going to give you just a quick call back, Jeffrey, just to get you on a slightly better line. We're hearing what sounds like almost like underwater dolphins.
Yeah, I hear that echo, too.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're going to call
okay,
back.
Okay, we're going to call you back. But Bonnie, let me keep you on the line here. And
sure.
Also, because what I also get from Jeffrey's book, and I also get from some of what you've written as well, and frankly from my own experience, is that, and I think this is a good thing, is that parents do and probably should have a different kind of relationship with their children. I mean, you can't treat all your children the same way because they're not the same person.
Right, exactly. I have, you know, on the issue of favoritism, my middle daughter, which is really, it's quite funny because, you know, the middle child has this, there's a stereotype surrounding the middle child that she kind of gets lost and that the baby's the favorite or the oldest child is the favorite and the middle one is sort of just, you know, rolling around out there sort of unmoored. But she's the one who so strongly insisted that she was appalled. She was appalled at Jeffrey's article. And you know, you have different. There are different aspects of your kid that you like to elevate. So, if you, for example, if I want to go to a science museum, I'm completely going to take my oldest child, my boy, because he's a science nut, and he has this cerebral side of him that I love. If I want to go, I took my 6-year-old into a bridal store the week before last because she started sketching fashion designs in her notebook, and we had just an amazing time looking at all these super. Super high-end wedding dresses, which is something that my son and my youngest daughter would just really not be into. So you have to figure out who your kid is, and you love and sort of elevate and honor the essence of each child. And I think that's, if you want to call that playing favorites, I guess that's okay, but I just feel like it's kind of getting to know who your particular child is.
Well, Jeffrey, let me quote from Bonnie's 6-year-old child. this is what you're up against here. And Bonnie said to her, "Do you think I'm lying when I say I don't have a favorite?" I asked her. It was a leading question, I know, but she didn't hesitate. "I know you don't have a favorite kid," she said, staring me down, willing that it be so. "I just know that."
Well, and as I emailed Bonnie after, because I think she commented that her daughter also saw the video of me saying this,
yeah.
I said, "Please tell her not to listen to the mean man in the video."
Yeah, exactly.
I realize that what she's saying is, what her daughter said is profoundly felt by all kids. And it is one of the reasons that I think it's really wise for parents never to mention it to children, right. Even if kids tend to know. And certainly never to use it punitively or critically. And there are some cases of that in the research. But again, I think that what Bonnie is saying, I don't know if this connection is any better, but I got back online in time to hear most of what she was saying about taking one child to the museum and the other
right.
to the bridal
right.
store. And I don't think that any of that is inconsistent with the idea that in the fullness of time, there still may be a child with whom she connects better than others. And in fact, it's hard to imagine that there isn't, in the same way that Bonnie says, you know, you have one friend you go to for certain things and one friend you go to for other things. We wouldn't feel constrained if asked, yeah, of all these great friends, who's your best friend? Who's the one that in a real period of crisis you would say, I could lean on this friend for anything and love her the most for that? And I suspect we'd be able to say that. I know, at least in my experience, I know I can say it, and I know that most people aren't shy about admitting it. I think we have those feelings about our kids, too, and there's so much internal and societal pressure not to admit that much, or not to admit that, that we tend not to say it. But I think in our heart, deep in our hearts, we have those feelings,
well,
all of us do.
Bonnie, we have to say goodbye to you, and I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times, and say hello to your kids for us.
Thanks so much, Marty.
You're welcome.
Thanks,
Jeffrey. Thanks so much. And that's Bonnie Rockman. She covers parenting for Time Magazine. In fact, wrote a recent essay for Time Magazine Online called Playing Favorites, Why Some Parents Do Love Their Kids All the Same. And Jeffrey Kluger is staying with us. We're hoping for the rest of the hour. And we will continue our conversation talking about siblings, the relationships between brothers and sisters within families. He's got a new book called The Sibling Effect, What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. And we had actually posted something on our Facebook page about playing favorites. And we would love to hear from you. You can talk about your relationship with your siblings and perhaps even talk about some of the incidents that reveal something about that relationship. And the lines are open at 1-888-477-9499. Jeffrey, I my brother and sister and I'm the youngest of three, and we're obviously, you know, much older now. And my sister, who's the oldest, my brother in the middle, she and I agree that our brother was our parents' favorite, but he's so much nicer than we are. I mean, of course he'd be their favorite. He's such a good person.
Well, exactly. And somebody, someone who knows or used to know my brothers and me quite well, once referred to my brother Gary as the white sheep of the family because, you know, we're all black sheep. He's the only nice one out of all four of us, she liked to say. And there's some truth in that. But Gary, as a middle born, like I was, never quite got that degree of attention that he would have if he had been a firstborn or a lastborn, I think. And Bonnie is right, by the way, that or inciting. Actually, I didn't hear everything she said because I was offline, but
yeah.
But I know she mentioned birth order, and that's a real variable in how preferences are established.
Well, in fact, you have a chapter on birth order, the oldest being perhaps smarter, generally speaking, smarter, more of an achiever, mm-hmm. the youngest being perhaps the nonconformist, the quote-unquote wild one, and then the middle child being the one that perhaps doesn't get the kind of attention that the kids at the other end get, of course, knowing that they're gigantic families, and then they're, of course, you know, just families with two kids. You're part of that middle crowd. Do you feel like a middle child?
I feel like less of one than I would have had family circumstances not sort of bumped me up to the number one position at some point. My brother Steve left for boarding school when he was only, I guess, 13, so I was 11, and he had had enough challenges dealing with our crazy family anyway, so that to a degree he was not quite fully equipped to handle the responsibilities of office, and as a result I was elevated and became what's known as a functional firstborn, and in many ways still am. You know, now that our mother is 80 and, you know, she requires someone to keep an eye on her finances and things like that, it's always me who handles that, and I don't mind doing it, and my brothers all concede that they have deferred to me in a lot of areas. That's not at all uncommon, and that, those first and second born roles can also shift in multigender families. You know, an oldest son may be looked upon to handle certain matters, and again, this does tend to conform to stereotype, but an oldest son may be looked at to handle questions of estate and handle questions of the family business and so forth. But when it comes to looking after the aged parents or making sure everybody remembers that mom and dad have a 50th birthday party coming up, or 50th anniversary, rather, coming up, or handling the family photo album, that tends to fall to a second-born sister. So, you know, these things, these roles, just like favoritism, can be fluid as well, but they do still have long-term patterns.
You say there's something like 20 million children in this family who are only children or single children, which is a lot. I'm not sure if that, that number is growing or not, but that used to be, you know, the lonely only child. You looked at some of the research saying not so fast.
Yeah, not so fast. And in fact, not only is it not the lonely only child, only kids actually tend to do a lot better than multiple children or than kids with siblings in some areas. They tend to have better vocabularies. They tend to have a more sophisticated grasp of world affairs, a more sophisticated taste in movies and books. They tend to have sharper, subtler senses of humor. And this all comes from growing up in a household in which they're outnumbered by parents 2-1. Also, to the extent that there were disadvantages in the past, they were mostly socialization disadvantages, that the kids wouldn't get that total immersion experience of being around other kids until they were in kindergarten and or nursery school, and by then a little bit of the clay had set, not too much, but a little bit. Now even that is less so, just because particularly in an era in which there are, you know, so many two-income families, there is no full-time single-parent caregiver to be home all the time with the child. So kids wind up getting plunked in daycare at 4 and 5 months old, which is exactly what happened with my kids, both of my children. My wife and I were both working, and, you know, by the time her maternity leave was over, they had to go into daycare. Well, they got immediate group socialization from infancy, and to the extent with only children that there's any disadvantage, and it's only a small one, that vanishes too with this early socialization.
We have about a minute or so before our second break here, but can you talk about the kibbutz effect?
Yeah, the kibbutz effect is great. It's one of the reasons that that brothers and sisters tend not to get romantically involved. There are a million reasons, both social and biological, that siblings, that the incest taboo is such a powerfully felt one. But one of them has nothing to do with biological relatedness, and that is what's known as the sibling effect, which was first observed in the early days observed in the early days of the State of Israel, when families lived on kibbutzes, and which are, you know, sort of communal farms. And the sons of one family tended never to fall in love with the daughters of another family and vice versa, even though the families would have loved that because it would help bring the kibbutz closer together. And what happens is we're hardwired to see proximity and presence, particularly from the time we're young, very young, as a sign of potential relatedness, and then and as a result to squelch any possible romance, because there's always a chance that this person is in some way a sister or a half-sister or at least a close cousin, in which case you run the risk of recessive genes mingling and producing less fit babies. So simple proximity tends to cool any sexual ardor.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Jeffrey Kluger is our guest today on the show. The book is called The Sibling Effect, What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us, 1-888-477-9499.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents Art After Five, a blend of jazz and international entertainment every Friday. This Friday, it's Hungarian and Roma music from East Gypsy Band. Featuring saxophonist Tim Reese, East Gypsy Band fuses the traditions of Roma music with the improvisational characteristics of jazz. Beginning at 5:45, more details are available at philamuseum.org. The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We hope to put this fall membership campaign to bed by the end of the week, and we can only do that if you become a supporter of WHYY. Think of what you get 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, a mix of lively and timely interviews, news stories, and entertainment. Your pledge at 1-888-345-9499 or at WHYY.org allows us to keep you informed. So do your part and become a member of WHYY. Thanks.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The music of Sir Edward Elgar could inspire the empire. Charles Dutoit and the Philadelphia Orchestra present Elgar's Enigma Variations. Also, Robert Schumann's Cello Concerto with Gautier Capucin. Tickets online, philorc.org. By phone, 215-893-1999. October 28th and 29th at the Kimmel Center, Elgar's Enigma Variations with Charles Dutoit and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Jeffrey Kluger. He's science editor for Time Magazine, author of a new book called The Sibling Effect, What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. And we've got a full bank of calls here. Jeffrey, let me get, looks like Valerie from Chestnut Hill to join our conversation. And Valerie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. My question is, have you looked at the effect of divorce on favoritism between children?
Divorce, as I said at the top, tends to bring kids themselves closer together, which is great. I don't think divorce disrupts favoritism patterns in any meaningful way. Unfortunately, though, on occasion in divorce, parents can make a hash of things by leaning even more heavily on and bonding even more closely to their favorite child, sometimes trying to use that child as a wedge between the other kids and the parents and the other parent, which can be a huge mistake. In the case of, you know, in my family, the analogy would have been my father using Steve as a way to pry my brothers and me from my mother, which is in fact what he did and acknowledged later on. It's just dreadful and it's destructive, and in all families it does nothing at all for the kids. It tends not to hurt the kids all that much because the sibling relationships tend to be pretty robust, but what it does paradoxically is damage the relationship that children have with the manipulating parents. So it's not good for the stability of the family, but you know, it doesn't really seem to affect favoritism patterns that dramatically.
And Valerie, I see on my computer here that a parent dislikes a child because it reminds them of their ex. Is that part of your story? Do we have Valerie?
Answered.
I'm sorry. Go ahead,
sorry,
Valerie.
I've experienced it in my own family, and then my family of origin, and then going forward now in my current family.
I'm sorry to hear that, because that just sort of keeps the pain of the divorce going.
Right.
And that if I may add, is a really, really important thing for the parent to be mindful of. It's understandable at one level that if your much-disliked ex-spouse had a trait you found objectionable, and you see a child who has learned that trait and exhibits it, sometimes painfully, it's easy to understand why you would recoil from that, but it's so important for parents to remember. First of all, this is not the child's fault. Mm-hmm. Second of all, this is not natural behavior, it's learned behavior. And third of all, your child has done nothing wrong. It is your spouse who has wronged you. Simply because the child reminds you of the spouse is no reason for the child then to feel that same kind of antipathy. In some ways, it would be just as unfair as if you felt less close to the child who most physically resembled your spouse. Well, that's not that child's fault either, and it's something that has to be kept in mind by the parents.
Yeah, Valerie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. A very painful thing to think about and talk about. Let me get Bill from, looks like Ballykinwood, to join us on Radio Times. And Bill, go ahead, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning to your guest. I'm the oldest of three sons. I'm 73 years old, and we have a father who is a very robust 99, although occasionally at that age he has to go for physical checkups and all that. My other brothers, one lives with my father, The other lives two doors away. I live 50 miles away in Philadelphia, but I'm the one who obviously not only was the favorite son, although my dad loves all of us, I'm sure, but I'm also the caregiver.
Oh, interesting.
And so it's interesting because my brothers and I have never argued, except when we were teenagers, of course, over anything, really. But it's assumed that I will be the one who will come down and travel 3 miles from his house to take him to the doctor.
Well, Bill, let me ask you a question. Are you okay with that?
I knew you would ask that question. And actually, at my age, my wife died 4 years ago.
Oh, sorry.
And I was a caregiver for her. I actually probably get strokes, you know, in a Freudian way for being able to do this. I seem to, looking back, know that I've gone through life kind of wanting people to like me.
Yeah.
I'm an artist, so
yeah.
I want them to like my art. And for me, I'm only calling because I find the whole dynamic fascinating.
Well, I do as well, Bill, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And let me see what Jeffrey Kluger has to say. Jeffrey, I'd be curious about your thoughts.
Well, this is one. This is a very good example, I think, of siblings working something out very well. One of the issues I deal with in the later one of the last chapters of the book, is precisely this: who becomes the principal caregiver as parents are aging, and how this plays into favoritism patterns. And it often can be a real source of resentment if child A was the manifest favorite throughout childhood, but child B, either because that kid lives closer or just is more temperamentally suited to be the caregiver, if that child winds up being the one who looks after an older parent, an aging parent, at that point that offspring can feel like, well, heck, I didn't get the goodies when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. Now I have to do the work while the favorite gets off easy. In the case of your caller, I think it's great that the favorite also winds up doing the work, particularly because the biggest variable in these things is usually geography, and the child who lives the closest, to say nothing of living in the same house, is usually one that carries the weight. So I think it's to your caller's enormous credit that even this late in the game, he's willing to say, I will step up and do this job.
Bill, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me see what Alex from Mount Airy has to say. Alex, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I had a question about the anger that... that you all had to deal with your father, and wondering what the effect is on, say, the child who is chosen, is the chosen person to receive the anger, and how you are able to get the adult to deal with the anger.
Mm.
Well, it's hard, obviously, for children to get the adult to deal with the anger, as it is, even if you're an adult, to get another adult to deal with his anger issues. Abuse by one parent on one particular child, it's called the index child, tends once again to hurt the parents more than it does the sibling. Typically, and this is a common example, and this is actually, as it happened to be, the precise example in my family. The abused child was the youngest, or the one who got hit the most was the youngest. The favorite, in my father's case, was the oldest. The special relationship between the favorite and the parent tends to be ruptured when the parent inflicts abuse on one child, and the favorite child tends to ally more closely with the damaged child.
Yeah.
At the expense of the relationship he once shared with a parent. This is precisely what happened in my family, and I don't know if it was my father's antipathy for Bruce that broke the relationship between Steve and my father, or if it was later things, but clearly, by the time Steve was in his early teen years, he had no meaningfully close relationship with my father, and part of it had to be that my father treated Bruce so unfairly.
And do you think that was a kind of loyalty to his brother?
Absolutely. It was a loyalty to the brother. And again, remember, siblings share experiences. They share pain together. I mean, Steve may not have been the one who was getting the most abused by my father, but he was afraid when my father was abusing Bruce, just like we were all afraid. And he was afraid when this loud, angry man was in the room, regardless of who his wrath was directed at a particular moment. So kids share that fear and they lean on each other. Now, I do want to stress, simply because there are families out there in which abuse is is constant and a defining feature of childhood. I don't want to pretend that we were battered children. I mean, that's a whole different kind of pathology in which bodies and minds can truly be laid waste to. We experienced nothing like that, but we did experience an erratic, physically aggressive father whose temper was a constant source of low-level threat. That's bad enough, but I don't pretend to have suffered in a way that other folks really have to put up with.
But I'm thinking about the example that you give of your older brother, who, as you said, had this alliance with his younger brother, who was being hit by your dad. But it seems to me that would create then a conflict. If you're the favored child, and you're favored by a parent who is hitting your brother, that's got to create a lot of inner turmoil for that child.
Well, certainly it creates inner turmoil for that child because you're grateful for and enthusiastic about the special attention you get from that parent. But again, you are closer in age and size and temperament and experience and all of those things that define your world. You're closer to your siblings than you are to your parents. Well, we all see the world through our own lens. And since my brother Steve's lens was the lens of a child, albeit a slightly older one, he saw what was going on the way my younger brother Bruce did. As a result, he could feel viscerally that experience more and empathize with Bruce much more. He couldn't really feel what an older, angry, physically aggressive man was feeling. It was just outside of his range of experience. Now, you know, all of this that's all just sort of a clinical and mechanistic way of describing what was going on. Another way of describing it is simple compassion,
sure,
loyalty.
You
know, even if it's the mechanism that drives it, it's compassion and loyalty that keeps siblings together and tends to push them away from a parent who's abusing one of the siblings.
Alex, I appreciate your call to Radio Times. You can call as well. We're talking about siblings. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me get, looks like Carol from Morgantown to join our conversation. And Carol, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm one of 10 children.
Wow.
I'm in my mid-50s, and I'm a twin, and I'm the top, four from the oldest. And when we were growing up, my father was a military family. There was favoritism by gender. I have 7 brothers, so I think all the sisters felt that growing up, and my family was very sports-oriented. And back in the 70s, girls couldn't really do sports, so we had cheerleading, and that really wasn't an interest. So, but my point is that when parents get older, and my mother's now quite sick, she's not quite sick, but she's a little bit needy, and I think all that just gets meshed together, and everybody forgets. And when you help her, you are her favorite at that moment, and it's kind of wonderful. We've all sort of come together, and it's just been great. It's been pretty awesome. Even though my mother is getting old, and we're seeing something happening toward the end of her life. It's been pretty cool.
Well, that's great, Carol. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Jeffrey, this is a wonderful story of just how families can come together, even if perhaps in the beginning there were difficulties.
Well, exactly right. And one of the points that this story illustrates is that even when there is clear favoritism, as long as all of the kids come out of childhood and say, and are able to say, I know that in certain areas, at certain times, I was mom's favorite, I was dad's favorite, or I was the one mom connected with, I was the one dad connected with. As long as kids don't come out of childhood having been on a starvation diet of particular and unique attention from their parents, all of the favoritism patterns tend to have much less meaning later in life and can often be a source of family laughter and even eye-rolling. And another important thing that this story illustrates is that these dynamics go on.
Right.
So the approval and favoritism, the attention of a parent, even when that parent is aging and the children themselves are middle-aged, that kind of approval is still very meaningful. It's still very real. As I said earlier, when my mother continues to deny that Bruce was her favorite, I'm very touched by that, even though she's 80 and I'm in my 50s.
And
she's still my mother.
Indeed. And that's Jeffrey Kluger, author of a new book called The Sibling Effect. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
And you are our favorite listener because you're going to be calling in at 888-345-9499 or pledging online at whyy.org. Hello, I'm Eugene Son. Chris Sotulo is also here, and we're asking you to make a pledge of support in support of Radio Times.
And Gene, I know that Mom always liked you best, but I've never held it against you because you stated that phone number so beautifully, and I want to compliment you on that. I will try to match it in saying that the number to call if you want to show your support for the great kind of in-depth, various, and civil talk radio that Radio Times provides would be 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. That is the number to call to let folks know that you appreciate the variety and the interest and the great questioning and the great guests that Marty Moscowane and her team bring into our studios and onto our air every weekday for 2 hours and also in the evening.
One of the things that's great about this program are the listeners who call in and add to the program. They're participants. One of the callers just this hour brought up what could just be kind of a jovial and light topic, brought up the more serious side of siblings and family interactions in terms of whether there might be some sort of abuse involved. So WHYY and Radio Times, we get at all angles, and it's all because people just like you who listen and may call in and be a caller to be part of Radio Times also call 888-345-9499 to pledge or pledge online at whyy.org.
You know, when I think of Radio Times, Gene, I think of two words that might seem to clash with each other, but they actually mesh beautifully in the way Radio Times comes together. It's reliability and surprise. The reliability comes from, you know, that if Marty Moscowane is on the air with a guest, she's thoroughly prepared. She's come up with every question just about that you could think of to answer the person. If it's an author who's written a book, Marty has read the book, or she has read a briefing book about the issue as thick as War and Peace to get herself ready for this. But there's an element of surprise because you're never quite sure on any given day where Radio Times is going to be going. Will they be going to the Middle East? Will they be digging in at Philadelphia City Hall? Will they be exploring an important issue in South Jersey? Will they be, you know, bringing in somebody from the Capitol down in Washington to tell you about the debt crisis or what's going on with President Obama? Or will it be something like this show about sibling rivalry, just sort of an amazing societal topic that everybody can relate to? How does that happen? That happens because Marty works very hard and her producers work very hard. How do they get the time to do what they do? They get it from you. They get it from your support, your pledges. That's why we're on the air right now asking for your support to keep this kind of top quality talk radio going. 1-888-345-9499.
That number is 888-345-WHYY, or this time of day, lots of people are by a computer. So surf on over to whyy.org to make that online pledge. It'll be quick and easy and one of the best things you'll do all day. I want to